sleeve. Hello, welcome to episode 23 of Art on Your Sleeve, a podcast about graphic design and music. In this episode, I look at the work of Andy Erfix and his design studio, Satori. Andy was very, very busy in the 1980s and 90s working with a lot of famous bands and artists, and we cover a lot of them in this episode, mainly the pop side rather than the rock, because I know what my audience is interested in. But there is a book coming out all about this exhibition and the work of Andy at some point this year, hopefully, and we talk about that in the episode. To read from the press release for the book, it says, Andy Erfix created some of the most memorable, iconic music designs of the last 40 years, working with music's megastars in the inspirational, unpredictable, and sometimes utterly insane world of pop music and rock and roll. The book, in his own words, is a unique opportunity for music fans and designers to see and read firsthand how iconic designs are created. The book was put together by his brother Tony, who I interview in this episode, who sheds a lot of light onto the sleeves that you'll probably be familiar with, but the stories not so much. Sadly, Andy died in 2018, so this exhibition that's currently on at the Museum and Art Gallery in Warrington is a lovely tribute to his work by his brother, so I would recommend you get along and see the show if you're in the area. So sit back and enjoy the episode, and I'll come back at the end to say bye-bye. Thank you for joining me to chat about your brother's work. I've been a fan of Andy's work since I first saw it with the Thompson Twins stuff in the sort of early to mid 80s. Was that about 83?
Yeah, it was 83 he started with them. And yes, all the way through the 80s was the Thompson Twins, yes.
Yeah, so I was actually an art student myself at that time and really loved the work that he was doing. So when I saw that this exhibition was coming up, I was there like a shot, because unfortunately I missed there was one in Brighton, wasn't there, about 10 years ago?
There were two in Brighton, one in 2013, which was called the Erfix Lounge, and that was to do with Brighton Fringe. And the other one was 2016, which was just after he'd recovered from a heart operation. And he was sort of relaunching just to say, I'm back.
So going right back to the start before the Thompson Twins in 83, the first sort of big commercial release, or certainly by an artist that was established, was for Sector 27 by Tom Robinson. Is that right?
Yeah. It is, that's correct, yeah. His first was Sleeping Lions, which wasn't commercially successful. In fact, they didn't actually release it. But yes, that sort of led him into Sector 27. And he was a designer in a gallery, cafe, nightclub type of place, which was run by Christopher Hunter, just off King's Road. And it was his artistic impression that impressed everybody, that that they just said, well, can you try doing an album cover? And he met Tom Robinson and they clicked, and Andy had ideas about different images, and of course there were no computers then. It was all cutouts, photographs, hand drawn, or all the lettering was done by hand. So that's how it all started, with Tom Robinson and Sector 27, which sort of broke him into the pop world.
And part of being part of that pop world was that he was very much part of the scene in London, wasn't he, in the early 80s, this whole kind of Blitz club scene, is that right?
Yeah. Well, Country Cousins was the sort of the first start of it. That's where he sort of introduced himself as an artist into Country Cousins, and got the owner to put some of his paintings on the wall, and that's where he got introduced. And Christopher Hunter, who was the owner, was very well connected. He was really good mates with the guy who owned the Blitz Club. And that's where people like Boy George, David Bowie, Freddie Mercury, and a lot of dignitaries from the music industry and the theatre as well. There were some sort of major sort of movie stars and really well connected people used to go there because that was their night out where they knew they were sort of safe and they could just enjoy themselves. And that's what started it all off, and how Andy met all the sort of dignitaries and the people.
Yeah, because you sort of think of the 80s as very colourful and exciting, but you know, Thatcher's Britain in the early 80s wasn't the greatest place to be. And I think places like that, like you say, they were a haven, weren't they, for kind of the creative community?
That's right. It was an escape for them, you know, because they could let their hair down and really have a good time. And that's exactly what happened. And fortunately, Andy was there. He actually did the sort of revamping of Blitz. He did the logo. He did the posters. And that's sort of was how he started off. He didn't start off as a graphic designer for albums. He started off as an artist turned sort of set designer for nightclubs, which then led into it being a business for album covers and then ultimately the tour programs as well.
So between that time, so obviously there's the Thompson Twins chunk of work, which was huge and very, very sort of well recognised. But there was an album for New Edition, wasn't there, that he did?
He did. That was a sort of low level one. But the other big ones that he was doing in conjunction with the Thompson Twins was Def Leppard.
Before we get on to Def Leppard, let's stick with the Thompson Twins. So there was the Quick Step and Sidekick album was pivotal for them as well, wasn't it, as a band, because it was where they'd slim themselves down to just three artists, and
that's right,
almost became kind of cartoon pop stars, if you like. They became very mainstream, had lots of hits, and sort of broke the international market. And a lot of that was to do with the way in which Andy helped package them up as a pop unit.
That's exactly right, because it was Pete Winkleman's influence as well, because he was a sort of the marketing side of the Thompson Twins, and when they all got together, it was Alana and Tom, I think, mainly, who were the sort of driving force with regard to the artistic side of it and the graphic side. And they weren't happy. They'd just been, or they were either just finished or they were nearly finished recording all the tracks. And this was going to be their third album. But as you say, as a slimmed down Thompson Twins. They weren't happy with the photographs and the graphics, and they just happened to say to Andy when they were in one of the clubs, "We're just not happy with this." And Andy said, "Well, can I have a look and let's have a see?" And it was then that Andy went along to I think he went with Alana, because Alana was really the sort of the artistic driving force. Tom was the sort of songwriter mainly, and when they went along, Andy saw the picture where Joe was slightly cut off, which was actually a rejected picture, and Andy said, "I can work with that. We can do something with that and make it look special." And that's how Quick Step and Sidekick came about, with that very iconic photograph with them sort of turning round. And from that, Andy also did those little cartoon avatars, which became their logo. Somebody's watching me. Now I'm nervous and I shouldn't be. Somebody's got their eye on me. Perhaps perhaps I should invite him up for tea. They were just absolutely blown away with it and said, we've never experienced like graphic design like this. And Andy said, well, to me, it's art. It's not graphic design. It's just it's the package. And Andy didn't sort of recognise that it could be called graphic design.
Yeah, and I think that there's something that goes back to what you were saying earlier about not being done on a computer that makes it feel more like art, that you're working with paints and pens and ink and cutouts, and it feels more yes. like it is more of a sort of physicality to the creation.
That's right. And Andy, he was very, very articulate and particular, and he was really good with detail. His attention to detail was so good. And the artists liked that because he was actually putting onto paper what was in their brains. And he had that ability where and that's why he liked to meet the artists. He didn't just like get the contracts from the management companies and the music industry and the record company. He did sort of insist on, I want to meet the bands. And it sort of came about from the Thompson Twins and Tom Robinson, because he'd met them before he actually met the music industry people to get the contract. So in later days, he just sort of said, no, I'll do album covers, but only if I meet the band and get their intentions and what they're trying to get over to their audience.
Yeah, I noticed there was one particular thing in the show at the Warrington Art Gallery that I really liked, where you'd included one of his little hand-drawn, with obviously done with rotary pens, and it had the tracing paper overlay on it. And just being able to see how much detail and hand detail goes into that artwork. You know, I think we take it for granted now that if you want a line, you just kind of click it and it appears on a screen. Whereas back then you had to pick how thick you wanted the line, select the right pen, put the ink in it. You know, it was everything was so laborious. And I think when you have an understanding of that process, it just really makes you realize how detailed, complicated and accomplished this work is, really.
Yes, that's why I wanted to do that. I wanted to sort of put a few more in, but maybe that'll be the Andy Airfix exhibition too, when I put more of the sort of build-up material. I think the one you mean is the dragon overlay, isn't it?
Where, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And that was for Black Sabbath.
Yes.
And it does show the detail, and of course the little notes there are for the printer, and it shows the overlays and but it does show from the very start where you just have a shape and then you put the outline in. So I just thought that was a really good thing to put in to demonstrate what, as you say, the detail that goes into it, the amount of work that goes into it.
Yeah.
Now you would just say to Google or the AI of this world, draw me a dragon head. And no, whereas that was sort of created from the band's intention of wanting to get to the actual sort of Norse mythology idea. So again, Andy would do the research on Norse mythology and look at the sort of dragons that were around, again, mostly in books, and because again, no internet to research it in those days. You had to go to the library and look for books on those sort of things. And and it fascinated me that was so intricate in those days, but came out so well. You know, the sort of liaison between the artist and the printer was quite key.
I have a picture pinned to my wall, an image of you and of me, and we're laughing with love at it all.
So he stayed working with the Thompson Twins. That was like a 7-year creative relationship that he had with them, wasn't it?
He did
three albums and then four albums and then a few singles that followed on from that. So it was very, very productive relationship, and it seems that Alana was very much involved, sort of hands-on with that as well. Did he ever talk to you about that creative relationship between himself and Alana?
Yes, well, I mean, I used to meet them as well, because at that time, during the 80s and 90s, I was working for BNFL here at Risley, and we had a London contract. I was working on Sellafield site builds, and we had a contract down in London. So every other week, I had progress meetings with the London contractor. And of course, I had free accommodation going down to, because they were usually spread over 2 days, the meetings. So I was often down there during that period. And when I wasn't in the meetings, I would be traveling down there. I would go to the studio, because that's where Andy was usually till sort of middle of the evening. And then we'd go back to his flat. But then the following day, I would go over, maybe over to the meeting in the morning. But then I'd be spending the afternoon and the evening in Andy's studio. And quite often, these pop stars would just crop up to see how things were going or just to have a chat. So I met Alana quite a few times. So that's why I know Alana was sort of mostly involved with the actual production of the finished articles of the albums and the tour programs. He had a calendar for them as well, so there were lots of different things. And she was a lovely lady.
It's this chat is actually quite timely, because as we're speaking now at the end of February in 2024. Into the Gap by the Thompson Twins was number one 40 years ago this very day. So our conversation.
Oh, I didn't realise it was today. I knew it was a 40-year anniversary. And of course, Alana does project management in London now. She hasn't been involved in the Twins for a long, long time. But she actually came to Andy's funeral as well, which was rather nice.
Oh.
Yeah, so you know, although I'm not in touch with her, I have been in contact with her. So, and it's always, that's always nice as well.
Yeah, and it's nice to see that Tom Bailey's taken the songs back on the road again as a solo artist, and it's nice to see that the graphics that he's using for that very much echo Andy's work. So there's a sort of
yes.
So before we get on to Def Leppard, because that's another artist, like you say, in which Andy's work, creativity, was very much an integral part of the pop package. But I can't ignore the fact that he worked with Phil Lynott and Fuzzbox, and also Rick did a lot of work for Dead or Alive.
That came about mostly because Pete Burns, who was quite an extravagant sort of person, he was actually a lovely, lovely person, and he was known to be controversial, and he was always regarded as difficult by a lot of people, but never by Andy. And all Andy said was, he wasn't difficult, he was just particular about, he knew what he wanted. Andy done the draft for the Youthquake album, and he'd done some kerning on the lettering, and he'd put Youthquake in the middle of the album, quite large, and Dead or Alive was at the top, but in smaller font. And the record company and the management company, when they went to the meeting, didn't like this, because they said, in their inevitable, we know best type of fashion, well, no, that'll look as though Youthquake is the name of the band, and that's no good. And Pete Burns just, and this is Andy's way of describing it, Pete Burns just absolutely blew up and said, this is what we want. This is not a cure for cancer. It's an album cover. That's the best thing I've seen that we've done. Andy and I have come up with this. It's brilliant. that's what we're having, get on with it. And he used a lot of expletives as well, which which I won't go into. But then Andy and Pete Burns left, and that was when Andy just said, no, this is when the, people say he's awkward, and I didn't find that. All I found was he was a joy to work with, and Andy liked the challenges of having something to get something difficult onto the sort of page. I was with Andy one time, and we went round to Pete Burns' house, I can't remember which album it was. I think it was Nude, actually. And Andy got some drafts, and I just happened to be there, and he said, oh, you might as well come with me. And so we went round, and Pete and his wife made us a cup of tea and cakes, and we went through, and Andy went through the drafts, and he was a real gentleman. If I hadn't known, I wouldn't have guessed it was Pete Burns, because he was so totally different when he was on stage to when he was in his home.
Yeah.
And I was just, what a gentleman. He was ever so polite, gentle, kind, you know, real nice sort of host when I went round. You know, oh, pleased to meet you. No, he wasn't like a star or I'm Pete Burns, you're not talking to me type, but he was a really, really nice person, which mm-hmm. I found for all the artists that Andy was involved with, oddly enough, I found really, really nice people.
Yeah, it's easy for people to misconstrue an artist's vision and being driven and having values about the way they want to be presented as being difficult and awkward and opinionated. It's they just want to get it right, don't they?
Yes. And quite often their stage appearance is totally different to their personal life. Mm. And a lot of people don't realise that they are just people. But they're not ordinary people. they're people that are doing extraordinary things. Yes. And sometimes, I mean, they can be precious and they can be awkward, but whenever I was involved with them, they were always a really, really nice set of people to be around.
And just to kind of recap on Dead or Alive, Andy did the work for the that peak period for Dead or Alive. So You Spin Me Round, yes. Brand New Lover, In Too Deep, Lover Come Back to Me, the album that you mentioned, Youthquake, and also Mad, Bad and Dangerous to Know. And It goes on and on and on. He was very much integral to all of those releases.
Yes, and they loved working together. And because of that, and Pete at that stage was very prolific. He was in the recording studio like almost all the time. He toured a little bit as well, but he was producing a lot of material, and so they had lots and lots of meetings and collaborations. And Andy did a lot of work, and they could do it quickly because Pete knew exactly what he wanted. For the Nude album, he wanted to have roses involved, and I went down one time, and Andy said it was spring or early summer, and when I went down, he said yesterday I was with Pete nearly all afternoon, and we spent the whole afternoon in a field of roses, and then we gathered some together, and we did a whole afternoon, Andy did most of the photography as well.
From one Scouser to another, he also went quite a bit with Pete Wiley, didn't he? And he did a couple of singles and an album there as well.
Yes. And again, all these things sort of came about because of the management company links. He didn't know all the bands necessarily, but the management company saw how how good Andy's material was, and they wanted the best. And they just said, well, at the moment, these, you know, you're producing really, really commercially good good stuff, and and they liked the style, and they liked the fact that Andy hadn't got something on the shelf for them, that he wanted to produce something original and unique. And and that's how he kept getting those sort of jobs.
Which is a nice segue into the work for Def Leppard, actually, because he certainly did that with them, didn't he? Kind of infused a pop sensibility into a rock band, which in a really nice way. It was, you know, what he actually did there with the first album, Pyromania, was quite considering, because previous to that, they'd been working with Hypnosis, hadn't they?
One of the things that Hypnosis were not famous for. I mean, they do really, really good albums, but they used to have them on the shelf. So when somebody went in, they'd sort of say, "Yeah, we've got this one," and which is something that they didn't want. And again, this sort of came about when Andy had it was in 1982, and. And again, the management had said, "Look, we've just finished recording this album, and it's going to be called Pyromania, and we want it to get away from the traditional rock, heavy rock type of image, where it's a motorbike with a scantily clad girl and just lettering on it. We want something totally different. Can you sort of come up with an idea that's different?" And Andy went into Battersea Park, because he lived quite near there. He lived at World's End, which is just across the road from Battersea Park. So he often used to go into Battersea Park and just sit and ponder. And while he was sitting in Battersea Park thinking about it, across the river, there's this sort of flats and skyscrapers in the distance, and out of the back of one of the skyscrapers, it wasn't from the skyscrapers, it was behind it, but there's a wisp of smoke came out, and he just thought, no, that's going to be pretty sensational, something, you know, like a fire coming out of a multi-story building. And he said, it won't be just a fire there. We'll make sure it's a sort of targeted attack, which is where the rocket sight that on the front came from as well. So when he took that back, and it just became a sort of a wow moment. And they all said, that's it. Fantastic. And Andy just done an outline sketch of it, but then he got an illustrator to do the building, and then he put together the flames and the rocket sight, and the other thing that they liked was it bled out of the album cover. It wasn't in a frame.
Yes, yeah, and again, all done by hand, wasn't it?
Yeah, all done by hand. Yes, this was all hand drawn, hand painted, and sort of some photocopying. But the other thing that he did as well was he hand drew the Def Leppard name. Yes. And that became their logo, with the red and the yellow and the outline.
Because that stayed with them, didn't it, until the next album in 87, the Hysteria album that followed that
all the way through. Yeah. Was absolutely massive for them. Yeah. That really broke them in America. That was the first one that sold 20 million in America.
It was nice in the show to see the way you assembled those nine different images that formed one big image as well. Around what were they? Were they singles or album variants?
They were 12-inch singles. Andy was had been talking with Joe about like the hysteria coming out. And again, the scary picture in the background, that was an original painting. The original working title for Hysteria was Animal Instinct.
Right.
And that was how all the album cover and the design was going along. But Andy said to Joe, when they were doing the sort of proposals and the initial parts of getting the album together, or the artwork for it, you released singles from Pyromania. I assume you're going to be doing the same for Hysteria. Why don't we use some of the cover so that your fans can have a 3-foot by 3-foot montage on the wall? And they all thought that was a great idea.
Yeah.
So it was Andy's idea to use the finished album cover broken up into segments.
It works for him creatively because it gives him a bigger platform to spread the ideas out. It also works for them commercially because it makes people buy them all for the set.
Exactly that, yes. And because I think there's 9 images there. In the States, there were 7 singles, but I think there are only 5 singles in the UK. But in the pack, there was a coupon to send off, and you could send off for the remaining sleeves that weren't going to be released as singles, so that you didn't have gaps. You could actually make the 3x3.
He went with Metallica, Black Sabbath, Judas Priest, Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, and did some tour materials for the Rolling Stones for their Urban Jungle tour, which was,
he did. I
love that work that he did with the sort of wild animal.
Yeah.
Do you know much about how that came about?
I know exactly how that came about, yes. And again, because I kept going up and down and was in the studio quite a lot, he'd just come back from a meeting, and Mick and Keith weren't happy with the sort of corporate look. It was called Steel Wheels, that tour in America, and again, the Steel Wheels was graphically done with cogs and the like, the merchandising company had over merchandised as well. They found that the sales weren't very good. So when Andy was in the meeting, they were talking about making it more sort of earthy, and they wanted it to fit the European market. They thought that the Steel Wheels was far too corporate for their European fans, so they wanted it to be more edgy. And Andy just happened to see a sketch that one of the set designers, because they were all in a sort of a group, the set designers and the band and the record company, merchandising company, and Andy saw a little sketch that one of the set designers had done, and he said, "We could work with that. I could enhance that image, and we could make that into a rabid dog." So it then becomes like the Urban Jungle sounds a lot better with a sort of rabid dog image. Yeah. So Andy expanded that image to be the rabid dog, which he called Skippy. The Paul McCartney, the one that it was for the world tour, but it was also it was like the McCartney years was what the DVD box set was called. But the eye image on the front was something that Paul had asked Andy about. He wasn't happy with the again, it was a bit like the Thompson Twins things. He wasn't happy with the graphics that were being presented, and in a Billboard article, he was actually being interviewed in America, Paul McCartney, during the tour, and he was asked about the recording and the album sleeve, and he said, I don't remember the words exactly, but there is a quote somewhere which I haven't got in front of me, but it was something like, "I wasn't happy with the design, so we asked a guy called Andy Airfix, who I'd worked with previously, to come up with something. And he came up with this image of my eye, and I'm amazed people could recognize it was me. And he gave that sort of acknowledgement to Andy whilst he was touring in America, which I just thought, what a sort of prestigious thing, not only to sort of mention that, but to actually know the name of your graphic designer. I just thought that was a real proud moment for me as well, because I thought, you know, how proud I am to be a brother of somebody who gets a mention from a rock star while he's in America.
So all of this and more is going to be in a book, I noticed, that's due to be published by your good self. How can people find out about this book?
Well, I'm still compiling it, and hopefully I'll probably contact yourself when it's ready, because little known to me, I've been pestering him, because with going down all the time, I became a sort of business advisor. As well as after I'd worked for BNFL, I left them and actually started working for myself. And I was working as a business advisor. So I was actually Andy's business advisor as well. And I kept saying to him for years and years, you should do a book like Roger Dean's done, for, because he did album cover album, and he did all the Yes stuff. And I said, I've got those, the 12-inch square, really nice books, you should do something like that. And he kept saying, yes I will. And it was only after he passed away and I got hold of his computer, I found he'd done the framework. So the image that you saw in the museum, actually Andy's done that, and he's done the 9 featured projects. He'd actually got those album covers as the sort of, right, those are the images I'm going to use. But he hadn't done any of the text. So I've been compiling all the text, and I'm getting now all the images together. And it's going to be about 50 pages long. So there's 9 projects plus some miscellaneous and some that he's called others. So that sort of means there's going to be 9 of the big images, which is fine, those are easy to do, but on the second page of each of the main projects, there's going to be 4 small images. So I'm having to find from his archives about 120 smaller images of the build-up for the artwork for each of these projects. Wow. And some of the additional covers. So it's a real labor of love for me, because I'm loving doing it, because it's giving me all the happy memories of when I was with Andy.
Thanks so much to Tony for joining me for this episode of Art on Your Sleeve. It was lovely to get an insight into Andy's work and hear some of the stories behind the creation of those classic sleeves. You can find some of the images that we've talked about in the show notes at softoctopus.co.uk/podcast. And in there as well, I've even included one of the flyers that he designed for the Blitz Club in the very late 1970s. Don't forget also that there's the Art on Your Sleeve Facebook group. So just search for Art on Your Sleeve and you should find that. And you'd be very welcome to join us, a very friendly band of pop and design enthusiasts. So we'll hopefully see you there soon. Bye.